Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has studied closely and been an influential figure in various aspects of that war, particularly here on the home front, most especially inside the Justice Department and analyzing what it's up to, is our first guest. He is Hans von Spakovsky, a distinguished figure in the Heritage Foundation pantheon of distinguished figures. He is a senior legal fellow in the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies there. He has served in senior ranks of the Justice Department, notably as a counsel for the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, and also as a member of the Federal Election Commission. It's always a delight to have him with us. Welcome, Hans. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes.
Frank, thanks for having me back.
Well, there's so much to talk about. Maybe we could start with your old haunts, the Justice Department. We anticipate, as we're speaking, that the government will be resting its part of the case today in the Paul Manafort prosecution. What have we learned about Manafort, his role in any alleged collusion by the Trump campaign with Russia, or really, for that matter, much of anything else related to that campaign and the Russians?
Absolutely nothing. Look, we had a week's worth of testimony, mostly by Rick Gates, who worked for Manafort and who pleaded guilty in exchange for his testimony. We also heard from Manafort's accountant. But look, all we really learned is that the chief witness for the government, Rick Gates, is a liar, a thief, and an adulterer.
Serial adulterer, it seems, for what that's worth.
Yeah, in fact, he was embezzling money from his boss, Paul Manafort. Now, the rest of the testimony was in essence about how Manafort and Gates were making all this money representing the Ukrainian government, and they got concerned about the income taxes they would have to pay for it. So they supposedly, in order to hide that income, set up a whole series of shell companies offshore to hide the income. They did things like try to disguise the income as loans coming from those companies to Manafort.
But not Russia, collusion, not the campaign.
No, in fact, a lot of these offshore companies were in Cyprus. So what have we learned? Well, Paul Manafort may have been a cheating businessman or didn't want to pay his income taxes, but all of this was over behavior that occurred many years before he spent a brief 4 months with the Trump campaign.
It does seem as though, as the judge in the case, Judge Ellis, put it, that this is all about basically bending Paul Manafort to the government's will, making him sing, or I think he said compose, which I thought was a wonderful turn of phrase, on the questions relevant to this witch hunt, as it's been described. Is that what's really going on here? Sort of criminal prosecution for very political purposes?
Yeah, I mean, they clearly want to convince him that in order to avoid getting convicted and spending a lot of time in prison, he needs to give them some kind of testimony against the president, against the campaign. But I don't think there's anything there for him to give. He was only briefly with the campaign, just 4 months. There's so far not been any other evidence of any kind of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. So, you know, Mueller's putting all this pressure on Manafort through this criminal prosecution, but I don't think there's anything there for him to get from Manafort unless Manafort just starts lying and making things up in order to satisfy Bob Mueller.
Yeah. Meantime, there has been much revealed of late about a fellow by the name of Bruce Orr, who has been prominent in recent months in connection with both his own role and that of his wife in this dodgy dossier business, all of which seems to have a lot more evidence associated with it of collusion with the Russians than anything we've seen so far with respect to Trump. This raises the question, Hans von Spakovsky, is this pretty much a giant deflection from what was really criminal wrongdoing of various kinds by various parties and, you know, sort of trying to get everybody to look over there, folks, not over here?
Well, it sure seems like it. I mean, I'm just amazed at the dichotomy between these two cases. I mean, on the one side, we have Bob Mueller spending literally millions of dollars with a huge team of people trying to track down collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government when there's no evidence of it. On the other side, we have a presidential campaign, the Hillary Clinton campaign, that paid a foreign intelligence agent to dig up all this dirt on President Trump, which he got from all these Russians.
Including Russian government sources, as I recall.
Yeah, and look, and we now have texts coming out, emails coming out, showing that Bruce Orr, who was the, I think, number four guy at the Justice Department during the Clinton administration, well, he was big friends with that foreign intelligence agent, Christopher Steele, had all kinds of meetings with him.
And his wife was working with the company that was paying Steele to do the dodgy. I mean, you just can't make this stuff up. And not just working for them, but she was the Russian specialist on the staff. Listen, Hans, you know, kind of my head explodes every time I think about, as you say, what seems to be a growing miscarriage of justice here in terms of the pass that's been given to Hillary Clinton and the persecution, is the right word for it, I think, of Trump and his team by contrast. But I do want to switch to one other topic before we have to let you go. You have been closely following for a long time this whole question of our immigration policies and in particular, the failure to enforce the laws, notably by Barack Obama and his unconstitutional action with respect to the so-called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA kids, as they're called. You've done some interesting research into who those kids were and the kind of protection that they were given. Walk us through that, if you would, quickly, Hans.
Well, it turns out that when people were applying for the DACA program, the Department of Homeland Security did not do what I'm sure all of us thought they would do, which is to actually verify any of the information being given on the applications or to do the most basic kind of criminal background check. And recently, Department of Homeland Security actually released a report in which they actually started doing that. And what did they find? Well, they found that it turns out that thousands.
Like eight.
Yeah. 8,000. So these people were individuals who, many of them had committed crimes before they ever even applied for DACA eligibility. And then once they got their you know, lawful present status, so they couldn't be deported, they committed even more crimes.
Hans, we are out of time, but there's much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll let us darken your door again here very soon. Thank you for the work you do at the Edwin Meese Center at the Heritage Foundation and for all your public service as well. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, Bill Gertz joins us. We'll talk about the U.S. Space Force and getting tough on China. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined by one of the great thinkers, scholars, analysts, commentators on matters involving Russia and before that, the Soviet Union. He is Dr. Stephen Blank. We find him these days at the American Foreign Policy Council, where he is a senior fellow. He has been a professor for most of his adult life in a variety of very important places, including the U.S. Army War College and the Air University at Maxwell Air Force Base and the University of Texas in San Antonio. He is a prolific author, has over 1,000 articles on all manner of things and some 15 books that he has authored or edited, a PhD from Chicago, and one of our go-to guys. Dr. Blank, good to have you back. Welcome.
Pleasure to be with you again, Frank.
Thank you. Let me start, Steve, by asking you about the latest development in the U.S.-Russian relationship, namely the sanctions that have been imposed by law as a result of the allegations that Putin's government was implicated in this chemical weapons use in Britain. What's going on with all of that, and what do you think is likely to arise from it?
These are the toughest sanctions that have been imposed by Congress to date. They go after banks, energy companies, and all manner of commercial dealings with Russian corporate entities. And the Russian government this morning said that this is essentially a declaration of economic war. That's their term. So there is a lot of anti-Russian sentiment on Capitol Hill for a lot of reasons, which many of our listeners know, the interference in the elections, aggression in Ukraine, and so on. The violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention and the attacks on the Skripals and, as it turns out, on innocent British civilians, one of whom has died, using Russian chemical weapons is something that Moscow continues to deny, but the evidence is overwhelming that they're involved. And Congress decided that since they have broken a whole series of international conventions relating to chemical weapons, that we are going to impose these sanctions on them as punishment for their crimes. And this is as tough as it gets as far as economic sanctions. So I expect that this is a decisive point in many ways. Although Putin is claiming he's trying to restore dialogue and President Trump has wanted to restore dialogue, the fact of the matter is that Russian behavior has driven Congress to this step, and the administration is going to sign off on it, I think.
Let me ask you, one of the retaliatory measures that the Russians evidently are imbruting is the cessation of supplying heavy rocket booster engines, the RD-180, to the United States space program, which has relied upon them for years now, something that I've thought was insanity, frankly, and I think we're trying to work our way out of with these private rocket producers. But what, as you see it, is the likelihood of that and the implications?
We need some history here. The reason that they have been supplying us with this is because in the 1990s, when the Soviet Union collapsed, so did the economy. And the idea was to prop up areas of the Russian economy that we thought could be converted to profitable and mutually profitable commercial use. The Russians happen to make the space rocket engines in the world. And the idea was that if we buy these engines, we will keep this industry from going bankrupt and keep it civilian. And, of course, the exploration of space for civilian technological commercial purposes is an enormous business, has enormous promise, and much of the way we live today would be inconceivable without the ability to use space, just, you know, as far as computers and television sets and even GPS and so on. Now, that program starts in the 90s, which is a very different world, and it has continued ever since. However, it has also become clear that the Russian space industry is also being used for military purposes. Nevertheless, this has been a very profitable sideline or venture for the Russian rocket makers, and very useful for the United States because we didn't have to make our own, and we were using the best in the world as they were. Now, I'm pretty certain Russia's going to stop this because of those sanctions. And even if they didn't formally stop it, I'm not sure that you could do it under the new sanctions law. That's an interesting question. I don't have the skill to decide that, but somebody else could.
Somebody will.
Right. Somebody will. Right. And it'll be in litigation and, you know, everything will be tied up for years. So I think this is going to happen. I think it's going to force us to find alternatives.
Indeed. Let me ask you about another piece of this. You touched on it a moment ago in explaining why Congress is so riled up about the Russians, at least in part, and that is the interference in our election influence operations sort of more generally, both the 2016 election and according to a whole slew of senior U.S. government officials, it appears the 2018 elections as well. Stephen Blank, this is not exactly a surprise, certainly to anybody who knows the history of Russian and Soviet conduct as you do, but where does this leave us as you see it at the moment in terms of, quite apart from the sanctions, the souring of relations with the United States?
Well, it leaves us in a state of siege, to be honest, I think. I think the only person who refuses to recognize this is the president. And unless he gives guidance, our defenses against this kind of intervention are going to be crippled. And I know all the reasons he gives for not wanting to do this, but they only add to suspicions about his conduct. It is really imperative that the United States take action to protect the integrity of its electoral process. And I think that applies, that any citizen should understand this. This is not a question of liberal or conservative or Republican or Democrat. It's a question of the fundamental integrity of American democracy. And it's not only American democracy. Other election campaigns in Europe and perhaps even in Mexico have been interfered with and are going to be interfered with by the Russians. That's their MO.
Do you honestly think, though, Steve, that the U.S. government isn't doing everything it can in this regard? It certainly sounds from those senior officials at the White House the other day that they are. Is there something else that the president seems to be blocking by his action?
Well, unless he gives guidance, their efforts are going to be limited. And they said that the president, for these actions, and of course they're not going to be publicized, to go into effect, the president has to give guidance, and he hasn't done that.
Are you thinking with respect to sort of retaliation against the Russians?
Well, I don't know if we're going to retaliate or we're just going to first protect the integrity of the election infrastructure.
Yeah, well, we'll be watching that particular issue closely, needless to say, as will a lot of others. Steve, let me turn to one other thing that you've really been doing path-breaking work on, and that is raising an alarm about the Russian efforts not only to be the dominant power in, but effectively to control the Black Sea, a major inland waters of the world that we have interest in, as do a great many other nations. What is Putin up to there at the moment? Do you buy that some of what he's been doing in the Baltic states with sort of provocative rhetoric and overflights and the like is meant to be kind of a distraction from what he's doing in the Black Sea? And again, what are the implications for us, for NATO, for Turkey, a putative NATO ally, among others, if this Mare Nostrum play seems to continue forward unchecked?
Putin wants to dominate the Black Sea and convert it, as you said, into a closed sea, where NATO cannot get access. And this is an abiding trope in Russian defense thinking going back hundreds of years. It's not something new. And the invasion of Ukraine in 2014 was connected to that because they were obsessed with the idea that they were going to lose their naval base at Sevastopol, which is on the Black Sea. So they have converted Crimea and the Russian military district, southern military district, into a really extremely well-fortified armed camp, land, sea, and air defenses, and strike capabilities. And they have, as Russians have historically done, then used that to project power out into the Mediterranean. And you see a quest by Russia for naval bases, some of which they're getting, all over the Middle East, and permanence of the Mediterranean squadron there in order to keep NATO out and to extend Russian influence. Now, they are also threatening NATO allies besides Turkey, Romania, for example, in the Black Sea, Bulgaria, too.
Stealing their oil platforms, as I understand it, as well as gaining access to some of their reserves. Is that right?
Well, they stole the Ukrainians' oil platforms. I don't think they've stolen Romania's oil platform, but they have threatened Romania in other ways, which apparently nobody really wants to talk about in public, so I can't go into detail. But I'm going to be in Romania in October. We'll see what happens. But the Turkish issue, of course, is very critical because there's a history of many wars between Russia and Turkey over the control of the Black Sea and Turkish security. But right now, Turkey is to a very large degree estranging itself from the United States and I think exposing itself to excessive vulnerability to Russia and cooperating with Russia and Syria on many issues. The Turks are obsessed with the Kurdish question, which they have frankly mishandled, and blame us for it. They blame us for the Pastor Brunson affair and for not giving them the air defenses that they need, which they do need. The Turks expect that the Russians are going to give them technology transfer and co-production over the S-400, which is the state-of-the-art air defense system. Most of us don't think this is going to happen and that the Turks will lose about $1 billion or more. But this is where things are going.
And Steve, for those of us who are geographically challenged, the control of the Black Sea is not possible, really, is it, without Turkish acquiescence, because essentially getting in and out of it is a function of the permission to pass through the Bosporus Strait. So does this really translate into essentially Turkey having to become sort of a client of Russia in order for this project of Putin's to succeed?
No, it doesn't have to go that far, but all he has to do is neutralize Turkey's effective contributions to NATO. And I think they've made some progress.
Yeah, that seems to be well underway.
Right. The access to the Black Sea is governed by the Montreux Convention of 1936 that states that during peacetime, Turkey controls access into the sea of all warships. So anybody wanting to send a warship through either end of the Bosporus, either into the Mediterranean or into the Black Sea, has to get Turkish permission.
Well, we'll look forward to your field report from Romania and your progress assessments of what's going on in the Black Sea and beyond. Stephen Blank, thank you so much. And as always, we appreciate not only your time with us, but the work you do at the American Foreign Policy Council. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with David Goldman a bit more about Turkey, what's happening there with its economy. Straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm pleased to say he's tanned, rested, and ready, as they used to say about Richard Nixon. I'm speaking, though, of Bill Gertz, our duty expert on what goes on inside the ring. That is, of course, the title of his prize-winning column at the Washington Times. Bill is also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon and author of best-selling books, seven of them, including most recently iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, it's good to have you back. Glad to have you have some R&R under your belt.
Hi, Frank. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you. Well, in your absence, I think there's been some dramatic developments in terms of the org chart at the Pentagon, or one that will certainly be revised soon, namely the announcement by Vice President Pence yesterday that the president's vision of a U.S. Space Force would be stood up in 2020. Bill, what are you hearing from your sources about the need for this initiative and the idea of creating this separate branch of the military to manage it?
Yeah, two elements for the impetus behind this new Space Force. One is the development of what they call counter-space weapons by both China and Russia. That is missiles, lasers, and maneuvering satellites that can capture and crush our satellites have triggered this concern that we have to really focus in much greater detail and operationally on dealing with space threats. The second is missile defense. Representative Mike Rogers, who is the chairman of the Strategic Forces Subcommittee at the House Armed Services, has been pushing for space-based defenses against these space threats and missiles from space. So those are the two key elements. Now, initially, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis was not at all enthusiastic and was concerned about how this new Space Force might affect his drive to create a more lethal and agile military force, which is kind of his driving vision for military reform in the Trump administration. But he's now fully on board. They announced and released their outline for this program. They're going to develop a space development agency, then they're going to do a space operational force, and then I think the transition step to a total service would be the creation of a space command, a combatant command for space.
Bill, I talked and mentioned this in my commentary today with Dakota Wood about this the other day and at the Heritage Foundation. He mentioned a really important point. I'd love to get your thoughts on it, too, that there are some 60 agencies of the U.S. government that have a role in space in one aspect or another of it, and that in order really for this force and capability that we need to protect our interests in space and to project power from it, we're going to need to see that sort of pulled together, maybe in a Coast Guard-like model. Any insights on that?
Well, I think that's probably certainly as good a good idea as any out there, but I don't think they've really thought through what it's actually going to look like organizationally at this new service. Like I said, initially, the Pentagon was pushing back to just make a space command, but the President Trump was adamant that he wanted a space force on par as a military service, and that will require bringing in, it's mostly the Air Force, basically. I mean, they're really the lead on space now, and I think it could be a good thing if the space operational forces come from the Air Force. Then the Air Force can focus more on air combat and nuclear forces, which is another responsibility they have. And then you can draw on all of these other elements, the intelligence community, the other military services, to create a really good space force.
Yeah. We'll be following it closely with your good help, I know. Speaking of your help, Bill, you've done a wonderful job of, as always, plumbing the National Defense Authorization Act, which has just emerged from the Congress. Tell us a bit about what is in there with respect to the evident growing concern of Congress about the Chinese communist threat.
Yeah, the Defense Authorization Bill, which is expected to be signed into law on Monday by President Trump, contains a number of great provisions which really focus and attempt to shift U.S. policy in a much harder direction in dealing with the threat from China, which is something I've been hammering away at for, you know, nearly 20 years. And so this is really good. I think the key thing that jumped out at me is that the bill calls for really toughening our policy towards Taiwan in terms of helping Taiwan. I mean, under the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act, the Pentagon basically has a responsibility to militarily defend this island from a mainland attack. And yet they haven't done exercises. So one of the key elements of the bill is it calls for developing joint exercises with the Taiwanese military, which is something that's urgently needed.
Beyond that, there are a number of other provisions with respect to Chinese investment in this country and the need for a serious national security scrub of what they're doing, the so-called Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, and some issues that I know are near and dear to your heart, Bill, in terms of information warfare or operations and the cyber threat, electromagnetic or electronic warfare capabilities as well. There's also an effort to map out what the Chinese are up to in terms of building bases. We're going to be talking shortly about that with a couple of our other colleagues, notably David Goldman in Turkey. But mapping out, you know, what we need to do as well in terms of trying to maintain stability in the Western Pacific, is it your sense that this is a concern that is now fully shared by the executive branch as well as the legislative?
Yes, I am sensing that there's a major shift, and it's coming from the top down, from the White House, basically. And like I said, for decades there. I've been following this issue where we kept hearing across government that China was not a threat. And even during the Bush administration, the Secretary of State said, oh, we want a strong China. All of that is out the window now. We've recognized that communist China is a nuclear-armed communist dictatorship that is on the march, and they're doing this through their economic power, namely this Belt and Road Initiative, which is a cover for expansionism by the Chinese. So there's really an urgent need to push back across the board, from diplomatically, economically, militarily, intelligence-wise. We saw just out recently, I was out in Aspen, and the FBI director said that the Chinese intelligence threat is the greatest intelligence threat facing the country, basically their efforts to steal our technology and secrets, other secrets. So there is definitely a change of direction, and it's very positive in my view.
Mine too. And I think in terms of influence operations as well, what the Chinese are up to makes the much discussed threat from Russia pale by comparison, it seems to me. Speaking of which, one thing that you've reported on, Bill, in your Inside the Ring column this week was this revelation that Dianne Feinstein's office, she's the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and now its ranking member, was deeply penetrated for, I think, 20 years, was it, by a Chinese spy. Talk a little bit about what we know on that score.
Yeah, this was a Chinese-American guy who worked in Feinstein's office, according to a statement put out by the senator.
Described as her driver, as I understand.
Well, actually, no. I mean, it was described, the initial story in Politico said that it was her driver, but in fact, it was an office director on the West Coast who was in charge of actually liaising with the large Chinese American community in San Francisco, which is a major counterintelligence target of the Chinese to try and do influence operations. So this person was, the FBI went to Feinstein in 2014 and said, look, you've got a problem. And she immediately fired the person, who has been reported to be a guy named Russell Lowe, a Chinese-American, very active in the Chinese-American community out there. So this is an unfolding story. And, you know, Lindsey Graham made the point, hey, why didn't the FBI do that in the case of the so-called Russian collusion related to the Trump campaign? In this case, that shows how they handled it. There really was no illegal activities other than perhaps being an unregistered agent, but yet the influence impact was great, especially in terms of a person who had access to so many of the U.S. secrets. As the chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Feinstein was read in on some of the most sensitive secrets in the U.S. government.
Let me ask you about one other thing that is featured in your reporting at the Free Beacon today. You spoke of missile defense a moment ago. Of course, the threat that is most worrisome in that regard at the moment is this hypersonic threat. The Chinese have just done a test. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Chinese for the first time have revealed their new hypersonic missile system, or one of them. I have been reporting for the past two or three years on a system, a glider, a hypersonic glider that's fired atop a missile and maneuvers without propulsion. Well, now they've unveiled a new system that they're calling the Starry Sky 2, and it's a powered powered propulsion hypersonic missile that can deliver both nuclear and conventional weapons through missile defenses. So this is this really highlights what I call the hypersonic arms race. Both the STRATCOM commander General Hyten just earlier this month talked about the need to develop not only defenses against hypersonics, but to develop offensive capabilities as a deterrent.
Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is such important work. We're delighted to have you back on the job, and look forward to talking with you again next week to get a further status report on what's going on inside the ring and why it's so important to all of us. Keep up the great work, my friend, at the Washington Free Beacon, at the Washington Times. And again, I commend to everyone your latest best-selling book, iWars, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, we'll talk to you next week. Next up, we'll speak with Stephen Blank about Russia and what is going on with the Black Sea and Turkey and more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to say we are joined, as we have the privilege of being just about every week, by David Goldman, a man who writes brilliantly and thinks provocatively about some of the challenges of our time, specifically in that nexus between economics, finance, and national security. You can find his writings usually under the nom de plume of Spengler at Asia Times, and he's also the author of an important book, How Civilizations Die. David Goldman, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Pleasure. Thank you for the kind words.
David, we were just talking with Stephen Blank about developments in the Black Sea, which led us into some preliminary conversations about what's going on between Russia and Turkey. But you have a kind of real-time report on some very ominous developments with respect to the Turkish economy. Give us an update about that.
Turkey's currency is in free fall. The lira is now worth 6.5 to the dollar. That's a devaluation of 70% since 2014, and about 40% this year alone. And the country is effectively bankrupt. What that means is that the businesses who borrowed hundreds of billions of dollars of foreign currency cannot make the debt payments. So they won't be able to pay the banks. The banks will be in trouble. It's so bad that some European bank stocks are collapsing because they own some shares of Turkish banks. So you have a knockoff. It's really like the collapse of Latin American economies under a great debt burden in the 1980s. And that's going to have serious strategic ramifications.
Well, before we leave the economics of this, walk us through how this happened, David, because as I recall, not so long ago, Turkey was one of the hot properties. The Saudis were putting a lot of money in there, as I recall, and there was green money, as they call it, flowing in, and a lot of people thought this was a promising emerging market. Where did things go off the rails?
Well, pardon my cynicism, but I see Tayyip Erdogan's Turkey as a typical third world kleptocracy, where you get an economic sugar high by borrowing a lot of money overseas, importing a lot, giving people a lot of consumer loans, with the result that Turkey developed a trade deficit roughly of 7% of GDP. That's kind of where Greece was in 2012 when the Greece economy collapsed. That couldn't go on forever. President Erdogan foolishly picked a fight with the United States over the arrest of an American pastor in Turkey at a point where his currency was already in free fall and his debt bubble was already popping. That pushed the Turkish economy and Turkish currency over the brink where it already had been teetering for some time.
You've mentioned, David Goldman, that there will be dramatic strategic repercussions from the cratering of Erdogan's economy. In particular, I wondered whether you were concerned that the Russians would fill the void there and become even more influential in the Eastern Mediterranean as a result, or whether there's another contender, namely Communist China.
President Erdogan gave a speech today offering defiance to the United States and saying there were three countries from whom he expected to get help: Russia, Iran, and China. China has the most money, clearly. Now, the Chinese major television station interviewed a number of prominent Turkish economists this morning and said, the only way to get enough money out of China is for Turkey to sell its major ports to China. COSCO, which is one of China's largest shipping companies, already owns two-thirds of Turkey's second-largest port. So they've already been doing this. But it's even to give an idea, Frank, of how bad this is, Turkey needs about $60 billion a year to finance its import bill. It's running a huge trade deficit. Now, of course, it'll cut that back. But if it sold off the entire stock market to foreigners, every share of every company, that would get them by for only 7 months at their current rate of spend. So they're going to have to sell state assets. And that's what's already being talked about, as I said, in the Chinese media. It's some of this has already happened. And so I expect all the logistics of Turkey to be under Chinese ownership in a year or two.
Wow. And think through with us, David Goldman, the implications of that. We've been talking with you and others over the past few months about this this debt trap scheme of the Chinese, notably in connection with their Belt and Road Initiative in South and Central Asia. But this sounds like a variation on the theme. And would it be the case, in your judgment, that the same kind of knockoff effect, as I think you put it, would be evident here, namely that it would be Chinese military personnel and assets that would be in those Turkish ports, not just commercial shipping and containers?
The Chinese have been very cautious about establishing a military presence in the Eastern Mediterranean. Russia has been doing their dirty work for them, in effect.
But they have sent ships in, as I recall, and exercised with the Russians, did they not?
Yes, they sent ships in, but they haven't done very much. They've talked about getting involved in the Syrian civil war on the ground for the first time, just in the last couple of weeks. But the Chinese will approach this cautiously. They're patient, and they're very calculating. Turkey got itself into its own debt trap. They just are sitting there waiting for the rotten fruit to fall off the tree. They really didn't do very much. But they will end up controlling Turkey's logistics, mobile broadband, e-commerce, e-finance, ports, rail, the whole works. And they'll effectively absorb Turkey into the Chinese economic sphere as if it were a Chinese economic province. Once they do that, their military options are open, and they'll decide how they want to play that at some point in the future. The point is, China will have the whole Eurasian landmass under its control, from Turkey on one side to the South China Sea on the other.
Mm. Now, one of the delights of this program is I have an opportunity to get a lot of very smart people talking about some important topics. And some of the other smart people that I've been talking to have taken a rather dim view of China's own economic prospects, that some of this build out and imperial sort of, infrastructure and asset acquisition is coming at a time when the economy of China is in serious trouble as well. How do you net that out? Is that likely to prove a break on its ambitions?
I don't know what serious trouble means, Frank. They're still growing at 6.5% roughly. All of the data lab people who use big data, on the ground observations, satellite photography, and so forth are telling us that growth is still well over 6%. So there's no economic crisis. They have all kinds of growing pains. Chinese are very efficient. It is a command economy, which makes a lot of mistakes. They wasted vast amounts of money in Africa, for example. But I think it would be very dangerous for us to operate on the assumption that China's own internal economic problems will hold them back. It would be nice if that happened, but it's not something I think we should count on, because those predictions we've been hearing for 15 years since Gordon Chang first published his book, The Coming Collapse of China. Since he published the book, China's economy has increased fivefold. So it hasn't collapsed.
Well, he is one of the sources we're taking aboard. So your point is well taken. It hasn't collapsed yet, that's for sure. We're watching it with great interest and growing concern, I think it must be said. David Goldman, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I'm so grateful to you for your time, as always, for your expertise, the work you do at Asia Times, and I know you'll come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do so again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.